Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the January 21st, 2022, Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy. Today I'll be reading the following main articles. Omicron variant may have peaked, by Meg Wingerter of the Denver Post. DPS prepares to close schools, by Jessica Seaman of the Denver Post. Biden strengthens message on Ukraine, by Michael Crowley and Stephen Erlanger of the New York Times Company. Panel seeks testimony from Ivanka Trump, by Luke Broadwater, also of the New York Times Company. And I'll be following up with miscellaneous articles. Our lead story, Omicron variant may have peaked. Health officials caution virus still widespread. Hospitalizations very high, by Meg Wingerter. With new COVID-19 cases falling in Colorado, public health officials expressed optimism Thursday that the state's Omicron surge has peaked, but cautioned that the virus remains widespread and hospitalizations are still very high. The percentage of tests coming back positive and the number of new cases have been falling for about a week, although it's not clear whether hospitalizations are starting to trend down, state epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Herlihy said during a news briefing Thursday. At this point, I do believe that we are seeing a true decline in cases in the state, Herlihy said, adding that she's cautiously optimistic that we have turned the corner with our Omicron surge. The state recorded an average of more than 11,000 new COVID-19 cases each day for the past week, down from an average of nearly 14,000 per day in the week ending January 10th. About 26.4% of tests were positive this week, down from a seven-day average of 29.4% on January 11th. The goal, though, is to keep that positivity rate under 5%. The virus appears to be in retreat in the mountain resort communities and the Denver area, although cases are rising in Pueblo, El Paso, and Mesa counties, Herlihy said. We are seeing improvements, she said, but of course those values are still really high. As of Thursday afternoon, 1,641 people were hospitalized statewide with confirmed COVID-19. That's a small improvement because hospitalizations have been bouncing between 1,650 and 1,675 for most of the past week. But it's too early to say that the plateau has become a downward trend, Herlihy said. Colorado's COVID-19 hospitalizations began rising around Christmas as the fast-spreading Omicron variant took hold in the state. Even though the new strain doesn't cause as serious an illness as its predecessors, the state's hospitalizations this month surpassed the peak of the wave driven by the Delta variant in November. The number of hospital beds available has increased somewhat in recent days, said Scott Bookman, the state's COVID-19 incident commander. Over the past week, an average of 93% of general hospital beds and 92% of beds in intensive care units were occupied. I think we have a tale of cautious optimism, he said. Late last week, a trade group representing Colorado's emergency room physicians asked Governor Jared Polis to activate crisis standards, which would shield them from liability if they cannot provide optimal care because their facilities are overwhelmed. Bookman acknowledged emergency rooms have been hit hard in the last few weeks and asked the public not to add to their burdens by going to hospitals in search of COVID-19 testing. The state is working with the transfer center to move patients to facilities with more beds and health care workers available, he said, adding that the virus's current trajectory should bring relief in a few weeks. Some people have speculated that Omicron's overwhelming spread could lead to the end of the pandemic, but it's not clear if that will be the case, Hurley, he said. New variants may develop, and it's not clear how long immunity will last, she said. I wish my crystal ball was clearer here, she said. Our next story, declining enrollment. DPS prepares to close schools, by Jessica Seaman. Denver Public Schools is moving forward with its plan to close schools in anticipation that the district will continue to see enrollment in its K through 12 schools fall in coming years, Superintendent Alex Marrero said during Thursday's school board meeting. The district will form a committee made up of families and other community members to determine what criteria should be used to determine if a school closes or consolidates. Applications for those interested in joining the committee will be available online starting Friday, he said. DPS expects to announce which schools will close by the end of next year, with the closures going into effect during the 2024-2025 academic year, according to Marrero's presentation. But it's possible some schools will close sooner because they are already struggling, he said. There are some who are on life support now, Marrero said. Enrollment in public schools has fallen statewide during the pandemic, with the State Department of Education reporting Wednesday that there were 1,174 fewer K through 12 students enrolled last fall compared with the previous year. The state saw a larger decline in enrollment during the 2020 to 2021 school year, when more than 20,000 students left. DPS, the state's largest school district, saw enrollment in preschool through 12th grade decline by 172 people to 88,889 students in October, according to the Education Department. More children are being homeschooled during the pandemic, and some families have moved out of state during the pandemic. A declining birth rate also is contributing to fewer students, according to education officials. Marrero, in an interview before the meeting, also blamed gentrification and Denver's high cost of living for the enrollment declines, which he said affects the ability of families and DPS employees to remain in the city. Many of the families we have traditionally served as a community can no longer live here, said Nicholas Martinez, executive director of Transform Education Now, who spoke during the public comments portion of the meeting. When students go, so does money allocated to districts and schools. For example, the loss of 6,000 students would result in the loss of $78 million, Marrero said. Turning to national news, Europeans flustered. Biden strengthens message on Ukraine, by Michael Crowley and Stephen Erlanger. Dateline Berlin. President Joe Biden on Thursday strengthened his warning to Russia about a potential attack on Ukraine, saying any movement of Russian units across the Ukrainian border would be taken as an invasion, a day after the president triggered alarm in European capitals with his suggestion of divisions among allies. Biden, speaking to reporters at the White House after hours of efforts by his administration to walk back his comments in a news conference Wednesday, insisted that he had been absolutely clear with President Vladimir Putin of Russia that a new incursion into Ukraine would be met by a severe and coordinated economic response. Biden retraced his rhetorical steps as Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with U.S. allies in Germany before a critical sit-down today in Geneva with Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov of Russia. After several rounds of inconclusive discussions over the huge buildup of Russian troops along Ukraine's eastern border. In his news conference Wednesday, Biden said a minor incursion by Russia into Ukraine could mean we end up having a fight with European allies about the appropriate response. Although European diplomats said Biden had been merely stating the obvious, his earlier admission that to what extent we're going to be able to get total unity among NATO allies would depend on the precise nature of Putin's actions, unsettled European capitals, including Kiev. It has also raised concerns that public signs of division within the United States and Europe, a goal in itself of Putin, analysts say, could embolden the Russian leader to mount a limited but still highly damaging attack on Ukraine. In public, top European and NATO officials were quick to play down questions of division. Speaking on CNN, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg rejected the idea that Biden had given Putin a green light to invade Ukraine with less than his full assembled force. Not at all, because the United States has been very clear over a long period of time, Stoltenberg said. Appearing alongside Blinken in Berlin, Germany's foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, said Europe had an unequivocal unanimous commitment to punishing Russian aggression against Ukraine. But the European view has always been divided about what to do and in what circumstances to do it. As one senior European official said, the punishment must fit the crime. He noted that even after Russia had annexed Crimea, it took nearly a year for the European Union to respond with serious sanctions against Moscow. In the current Ukraine crisis, the leaders of Germany's new governing coalition have stopped short of a commitment to halt the $11 billion Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline, a joint Russian-German project that U.S. officials fear will enrich Putin and give him further leverage over European energy supplies. And on Wednesday, President Emmanuel Macron of France surprised and irritated many European Union colleagues with an address to the EU Parliament in Strasbourg, in which he called on Europeans to come up with their own proposal on European security. We must build it between Europeans, then share it with our allies within the framework of NATO, he said, and then propose it for negotiation to Russia. French officials said Thursday that Macron was not seeking to undermine NATO's unity, but the net effect of the words by Biden and Macron accentuated the frictions within the Western alliance, analysts said, a potential advantage for Russia. Biden's comments, coinciding with Macron's speech, looks uncoordinated, and given all the efforts U.S. officials have spent traveling around Europe to keep people solid, it seems odd and didn't need saying, said Robin Niblett, director of Chatham House, a London-based research organization. Musings about gradations of response opened up the can to put question marks back into the Allied part of the debate. Biden was asked on Wednesday whether the United States and its European allies could agree on what sanctions to impose on Russia should it further assault Ukraine, where it has supported a separatist war for nearly 7 years. Europeans and NATO are united with the United States in opposing any further Russian incursion into Ukraine, in pledging support of various kinds for Ukraine, and in promising massive costs to Russia. But neither the United States nor Europe have detailed the exact steps they intend to take. U.S. and European officials have said that it was vital not to give Putin ammunition by publicly discussing red lines. But Biden's comments hinted at disagreements happening behind the scenes. It's very important that we keep everyone in NATO on the same page, Biden responded. That's what I'm spending a lot of time doing. There are differences. There are differences in NATO as to what countries are willing to do, depending on what happened, the degree to which they're able to go. Ukrainian officials, among others, expressed dismay after Biden's comments Wednesday. We want to remind the great powers that there are no minor incursions, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, wrote on Twitter on Thursday. During a Thursday stop in Berlin en route to a meeting today in Geneva with Russia's foreign minister, Blinken added his voice to the cleanup effort. Blinken said that if any Russian military forces move across the Ukrainian border in an act of aggression, the United States and its allies would deliver a swift, severe, and united response. The Biden administration announced Thursday that it would impose sanctions on four people it accuses of engaging in influence activities on behalf of Russia to destabilize Ukraine in advance of a potential invasion. While in Berlin, Blinken conducted a flurry of diplomacy on the eve of his high-stakes meeting with his Russian counterpart, Lavrov, which could help determine whether a diplomatic solution to the crisis induced by Putin's army can be achieved. Blinken met with Germany's foreign minister and its new chancellor, Olaf Scholz, and with diplomats from Germany, France, and Britain, who gathered under the moniker of the Transatlantic Quad. He later said the showdown with Moscow over Ukraine is a crisis with global consequences for the international system of established borders and state sovereignty. Capitol breach. Panel seeks testimony from Ivanka Trump by Luke Broadwater. Dateline, Washington. The House committee investigating the January 6th riot on Thursday requested cooperation from Ivanka Trump as it revealed pieces of what it has learned about a scramble inside the White House that day to get former President Donald Trump to denounce and call off the mob that was laying siege to the Capitol. In a letter to Ivanka Trump, the former president's eldest daughter, who served as one of his senior advisors, the committee said it had obtained evidence that multiple White House officials, including Ivanka Trump, at least twice had implored Donald Trump to call off the violence, only to be rebuffed. But aides at the time were also worried about Donald Trump issuing anything other than a scripted statement during the mayhem. Apparently, certain White House staff believed that a live, unscripted press appearance by the president in the midst of the Capitol Hill violence could have made the situation worse, wrote Representative Benny Thompson, a Democrat from Mississippi, the panel's chair. The summoning of Ivanka Trump suggested that the committee was delving deeper into the question of what Donald Trump was doing and saying while the attack unfolded, as it seeks to determine his intentions and state of mind during the assault. The letter also made clear that the panel has uncovered substantial evidence about those critical hours inside the White House from key players who were present that day. In the letter, Thompson wrote that investigators had received information from Keith Kellogg, a retired lieutenant general who was Vice President Mike Pence's national security advisor, about Donald Trump's refusal to condemn the violence, despite White House officials urging him to do so. Kellogg testified that Donald Trump had rejected entreaties by him as well as Mark Meadows, his chief of staff, and Kayleigh McEnany, the White House press secretary. Kellogg then appealed to Ivanka Trump to intervene. She went back in because Ivanka can be pretty tenacious, Kellogg testified. He also told investigators that he had recommended very strongly against the president speaking on live television because his press conferences tend to get out of control. The committee also revealed that Kellogg testified that he and Ivanka Trump witnessed a telephone call in the Oval Office on the morning of January 6th, in which Donald Trump pressured Pence to go along with a plan to throw out electoral votes for Joe Biden when Congress met to make its official count of the results, thus invalidating the 2020 election and allowing Trump to stay in office. Kellogg told the committee that the president had accused Pence of not being tough enough to overturn the election. Ivanka Trump then turned to Kellogg and said, "Mike Pence is a good man," Kellogg testified. The committee has information suggesting that President Trump's White House counsel may have concluded that the actions President Trump directed Vice President Pence to take would violate the Constitution or would be otherwise illegal, Thompson wrote to Ivanka Trump. Did you discuss those issues with any member of the White House counsel's office? A spokesperson for Ivanka Trump said Thursday that she had just learned that the committee issued a public letter asking her to appear. As the committee already knows, Ivanka did not speak at the January 6th rally, the spokesperson said in a statement. As she publicly stated that day at 3:15 p.m., "Any security breach or disrespect to our law enforcement is unacceptable. The violence must stop immediately. Please be peaceful." The request for Ivanka Trump's cooperation came the day after the panel won a major victory when the Supreme Court refused a request from the former president to block the release of White House records concerning the January 6th attack, effectively rejecting Donald Trump's claim of executive privilege and clearing the way for the House committee to start receiving the documents. Within hours of that decision Wednesday night, the National Archives began the process of turning over hundreds of pages of documents to the committee. A representative for the committee said Thursday that it had received some of the documents and expected the rest to be delivered as quickly as the archives could produce them. Thompson told reporters on Capitol Hill on Thursday that the committee would consider posting the documents publicly, including any fake electoral certificates for Trump that it obtains after its investigators review the documents. The committee's letter to Ivanka Trump also included evidence from court transcripts that showed how Donald Trump's public statements against Pence on January 6th resonated with rioters. "Once we found out Pence turned on us and that they had stolen the election, like officially, the crowd went crazy," one defendant said. "I mean, it became a mob. We crossed the gate." Another testified, "We heard the news on Pence," adding, "So we stormed." The letter also revealed text messages from allies of Trump who believed he was going too far in his attempts to overturn the election. One message from an unidentified member of the House Freedom Caucus, who was aware of the president's plans, warned Meadows that if POTUS allows this to occur, we're driving a stake in the heart of the federal republic. After January 6th, Meadows and Representative Jim Jordan, an Ohio Republican who has refused to cooperate with the committee, received a text message from Sean Hannity, a Fox News host, laying out recommendations for how Donald Trump should behave. "He can't mention the election again, ever," Hannity wrote January 10th, according to the committee. "I did not have a good call with him today, and worse, I'm not sure what is left to do or say." The letter to Ivanka Trump was the committee's latest step to try to obtain information from Trump's inner circle, including his family, about the events that led up to the Capitol riot. The panel also sought logs of phone calls and text messages between the former president's son, Eric Trump, and Kimberly Guilfoyle, the girlfriend of another son, Donald Trump Jr., according to CNN. Also on page one is a cute photo taken by Andy Cross of the Denver Post with the headline, Rope That Doggie. And the description is Jeremiah Garner, 6, a kindergartner at Swansea Elementary, tries his hand at calf roping with encouragement from Miss Rodeo New York, Madeline Jurenko, during the PRCA, Exceptional Rodeo, at the CSU Spur campus's Temple Grandin Equine Center on Thursday. The annual rodeo, part of the National Western Stock Show, is an adaptive rodeo and equestrian experience that provides Denver area children with special needs the chance to be a cowboy or cowgirl for the day. Turning to page two, County's Disaster Assistance Center to close. The Boulder County Disaster Assistance Center in Lafayette will close to in-person services at 5 p.m. Saturday as the response shifts to longer-term recovery in the aftermath of the Marshall Fire. Those who have been displaced or affected can continue to receive assistance and information online at boco.org/Marshall Fire, while agencies plan to provide additional targeted outreach and support. We know it has been challenging for some to even get to a disaster assistance center, said county spokesperson Jim Williams. People can let us know the full range of things that they will need. Since opening January 3rd, the Boulder County Disaster Assistance Center has helped more than 2,000 households with more than $5 million in direct assistance and $30 million in disaster loans. Other assistance included help navigating claims filing, cleanup and debris removal, mental health services, and other immediate needs. The Joint Federal-State Disaster Recovery Center at 1755 South Public Road in Lafayette will continue to operate in the south half of the building. Agencies include the Federal Emergency Management Agency and U.S. Small Business Administration. And that was from the Daily Camera. And we've got this brief from Kieran Nicholson of the Denver Post. Two winners to split $25 million Colorado Lotto Plus jackpot. Two people will split a $25 million jackpot after purchasing prize-winning tickets in the Colorado Lotto Plus. The $25 million prize is the second highest Colorado Lotto Plus jackpot. A $27 million jackpot was won in 1992 by a single player. Each new winner will claim $12.5 million, and each winner will claim separately, the Colorado Lottery said in a Thursday news release. The jackpot winning numbers were 5, 8, 12, 18, 36, and 40. The jackpot winning tickets were sold at a Safeway Fuel Center, 626 Colorado 105 in Monument, and through the Winner's Circle in Pueblo, a Jackpocket mobile app. If one or both winners take the lump sum option rather than a 25-year annuity, the amount per winner will be $6.25 million before taxes, the state said. Our next story, Homelessness, Report Reveals Rough Picture, by Joe Rubino of the Denver Post. More first-timers, greater percentage of people of color found. The number of people in Metro Denver who reported experiencing first-time homelessness in 2021 nearly doubled over 2020, according to a new report. And people of color make up a disproportionately high percentage of the unhoused in the Denver area, the report found. The Metro Denver Homeless Initiative on Thursday released its second annual State of Homelessness report, going beyond the once annual point-in-time count of people living in emergency shelters or on the streets the organization leads. The report pulls together data from multiple sources to provide a more holistic view of homelessness, according to the officials. When COVID hit, really in an effort to keep people safe and know where they are, we had a lot more street outreach, safe outdoor spaces, the Safe Parking Initiative. Jamie Rife, the initiative spokeswoman, said Thursday, speaking broadly about service providers across the metro area. What that allowed us to do was more quickly reconnect people with resources and help to keep them safe, but also to understand that population much better. Now we have much better data. This year's report provides three totals for people experiencing homelessness across Denver, Adams, Arapahoe, Boulder, Broomfield, Douglas, and Jefferson counties. The seven counties will be doing an in-person count again on Monday night. Using data from the metro area's homeless management information system, the shared information collection point used by nearly 75% of shelters and all federally funded service providers, the report counted 32,233 people who accessed services or housing support related to homelessness at least once from July 1st to June 30th. While the in-person point-in-time count for 2021 was canceled out of concern for COVID-19 safety, using data pulled from the system, the report found that 5,530 people stayed in shelters, transitional housing, or safe haven sites on the night of February 21, 2021. That's a decrease from the 6,104 people in the 2020 point-in-time count. But the 2021 point-in-time number included only data from about 75% of shelters. The 2020 figure also included an in-person count of considered unsheltered, those sleeping in tents, cars, and other places not meant for human habitation. The 2021 survey did not. Overall, the initiative's report found about 40% of people experiencing homelessness in Metro Denver are unsheltered on any given night. What the 2021 point-in-time data revealed was major increases in emergency shelter use and the number of people reporting first-time homelessness. There were 2,530 people in shelters on February 26, 2021, that reported being newly homeless, up from 1,273 people during the January 2020 count, a sign of the crushing impact of COVID-19 on housing security in the Denver area, service providers said. I anticipate an increase, said Rife, who will take over as the Metro Denver Homeless Initiative's executive director next month. I don't know that I fully anticipate that sort of increase. Finally, the report relied on data from the 2019-2020 school year to count 11,830 students in the metro area who were identified as experiencing homelessness by their school districts. That count used different definitions than the database. Regardless of definition or method, one thing stood out to Rife in the report. Black, indigenous, and people of color were overrepresented in the numbers compared with white people. Among 10,870 unsheltered adults counted by the shared data system, 22.7% were black, more than 4.4 times greater than the percentage of black people in the metro population at large. Of 952 unsheltered youths counted, 24.5% were black. That tells us that there are a lot of structures and systemic issues that need to be addressed that contribute to this overrepresentation, Rife said. Criminal justice reform, child welfare reform, health care, these are all things that disproportionately affect people of color that lead to things like homelessness and living in poverty. There was a silver lining in the report. The data showed a 15% decrease in the number of veterans experiencing homelessness, giving Rife hope that the challenges can be overcome with regional coordination and collaboration. And the Denver Post has five obituaries and memoriams today, so I will read the basics from those. Bobby Markham, born October 16, 1931, and died December 16, 2021. Bobby G. Markham passed away on December 16, 2021, at the age of 90. A detailed obituary can be found at drinkwinemortuary.com. In lieu of flowers, you can give to goodsports.org under the tab Donate Now. Services are planned at the Drinkwine Chapel on January 28th at 1 p.m. And Bobby worked in finance at Martin Marietta. Laron David Frazier, born October 14, 1981, and died December 31, 2021. Laron grew up in South Jefferson County near Morrison. He worked in the restaurant business with positions at the Morrison Inn, Governor's Park Tavern, and Paxty's Uptown. Laron leaves behind his parents, Frank and Carol, his adored sister, Jessica, his brother-in-law, Brandon, who he admired beyond words, his niece Francesca, his nephew Kayan. He also leaves behind a large contingent of aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, and cousins. And he is missed by his rescued and best fur friend and godsend, Murphy. At this time, there are no services planned. However, when it is advisable and safe, the family is planning to have a celebration in the near future, and plans will be announced at that time. Nancy Tanya Stevenson Hogan, born May 26, 1931, and died January 16, 2022, surrounded by her five children, with her 14 grandchildren holding her in their hearts. Words can't capture her essence or her legacy. Services will be at 11 this Saturday on January 22nd at Eisenhower Chapel on Roslyn Street in Denver. Kit Held Johnson, born August 12, 1977, and died December 12, 2021. Kit, 44 years old, died of natural causes at home in Parker, Colorado. He is survived by his mother, Donna Held, his uncle, Kenneth Held, and many cousins and friends. He was predeceased by his father, Christopher Johnson, British, his beloved grandparents Sydney and Violet Held, and Johnny and Elizabeth Johnson, England. He will be laid to rest at Horan and McConaty's Cremation Gardens in Centennial. A memorial and celebration of life will hopefully be held at a later date when it is safe to gather. Harry L. Taggart, 89, of Denver, passed away January 7, 2022, of natural causes. Harry is predeceased by his beloved wife, Earlene A. Taggart. He is survived by two loving daughters, Linda Hawk and Bobby Underwood, a sister, three grandchildren, and seven great-grandchildren. A memorial service is being planned at a later date for family and close friends. And in other news, there is a photo with the headline, Free Masks Draw a Crowd. And the description says, people line up outside the Louisville Public Library before it opens Thursday to get free KN95 and surgical-grade masks. Colorado announced a day earlier it would give out the free masks as part of the state's ongoing effort to stop the spread of COVID-19. Mask distribution sites are listed at covid19.colorado.gov/free masks. And the photo was taken by Jeff Grasmick of the Daily Camera. Medical bills. Answers about state law and federal No Surprises Act by Meg Wingerter of the Denver Post. Coloradans not covered by the state's law preventing surprise medical bills now have similar protection under a federal law, but there are a few important differences. The Colorado law and the federal No Surprises Act, which took effect January 1st, limit how much you can be charged if you get emergency care from an out-of-network hospital or happen to have an out-of-network doctor at an in-network hospital. Until recently, patients have been hit with bills, sometimes adding up to tens of thousands of dollars, if they couldn't ensure everyone involved in their care team had a contract with their insurance companies. Despite the name, the No Surprises Act doesn't mean you won't get a larger bill than you expected. For example, if you get relatively low-level care, like stitches, at an emergency room, you might still have some sticker shock when you see the fees that come in with it. Those situations are not considered surprise bills under state or federal law. Following are the answers to some common questions about the Colorado and federal laws. This all goes back to the never-ending dance between healthcare providers and insurance companies. Hospitals want to get paid as much as possible, and insurers want to pay out as little as possible. If they can reach an agreement that satisfies both, the hospital is part of the insurer's contracted network. This matters for customers because insurance plans are set up to encourage you to use in-network providers. For example, some plans make you pay a higher percentage of the total cost of your hospital stay if you go to a facility that's not in their network. That's still allowed for non-emergency care. For example, if you choose an out-of-network hospital for a planned surgery because you've heard good things from people who went there. What the federal and state laws attempt to do is protect you from unexpected bills if you didn't intentionally go out of network. Under the No Surprises Act, your insurance company can bill you only what you would pay with an in-network provider. The hospital or healthcare provider also cannot send you a balance bill, the difference between what they charged and what your insurance company was willing to pay. For example, say you normally owe $100 for an emergency room visit under your health plan. Your insurance company pays $5,000 to in-network emergency rooms for the type of care you received and the out-of-network hospital you went to wants to charge $10,000. If you went to an out-of-network ER, you would still owe $100. And the hospital could not send you a bill for the $5,000 your insurance company did not cover. The protections apply to care in emergency rooms and air ambulances as well as any post-emergency care that's needed before you could transfer safely to an in-network facility, according to an analysis from the Kaiser Family Foundation. You're also protected if you go to an in-network hospital and receive care from an out-of-network provider. For example, if you chose an in-network hospital and surgeon, but the anesthesiologist who puts you under is from outside the network, you still pay the in-network rate for your sedation. If the insurance company and the provider cannot agree on what the services should have cost, that's generally not going to be your problem, and they can settle it through arbitration. Health industry trade groups aren't happy about the details, which they feel give too much leverage to insurers. In the vast majority of cases, regardless of what insurance plan you have, you should be largely protected from balance billing, said Adam Fox, deputy director of the Colorado Consumer Health Initiative. The federal law covers hospitals, including their outpatient departments, freestanding emergency rooms, and ambulatory surgery centers. Some urgent care centers may be included if they're licensed to provide the equivalent of emergency room care, but you should check before seeking care at one. You're not protected in other facilities, such as non-hospital birthing centers, addiction treatment facilities, nursing homes, or outpatient clinics. The federal law also doesn't include ground ambulances. If you're uninsured, the law requires only that providers give you a good faith estimate of what they may charge. Colorado's surprise billing law, which took effect in 2020, limits the circumstances in which providers can ask you to waive your protections. One concern about the federal law is that although providers are supposed to get patients' consent to waive protection 72 hours before planned procedures, patients may still feel ambushed at the last minute and that they have no choice but to sign if they want care, Fox said. That is one of the key differences between the laws, he said. The state law also protects you if you're transported by a privately owned ground ambulance company, but you're not protected if a county emergency medical services department that isn't in your network with your insurance transports you. At the federal level, that is very much a gap, Fox said. At the state level, we still have a bit of a gap. Another important difference is what can happen once you've been stabilized after an emergency. Under Colorado law, if you went to an out-of-network hospital for something such as a heart attack, you can't be charged out-of-network rates until you're well enough to decide if you want to stay in place and pay them or be transferred to an in-network hospital. Federal regulations related to the No Surprises Act put additional limits on when you could be charged out-of-network rates after an emergency, said Megan Axelrod, regulatory policy manager at the Colorado Hospital Association. Under those rules, you must be well enough that the transfer doesn't require an ambulance, and there must be an in-network hospital within a reasonable distance. So, for example, if your heart attack took place on vacation in a part of the country where your insurance company doesn't contract with any hospitals, you cannot be charged out-of-network rates because it's not feasible for you to drive for hours while still recovering. The goal is the same, but the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services guidance is way more specific and in the weeds, she said. If your insurance card has DOI printed on it, your plan is regulated by the state, and the Colorado protections all apply to you. That includes plans sold on the individual marketplace as well as a few large employer plans. If your plan is not state regulated, you get only the federal protections. That is most likely going to be the case if you're covered by a large group plan. Hospitals are still trying to clarify what to do if it's not clear what insurance a patient has and which laws govern it, Axelrod said. She said they hope to see the state and federal laws brought into alignment as much as possible to prevent confusion. There are certain things that are just different, she said. If you're scheduling a medical procedure, you still may save yourself some headaches by checking whether all of your providers are in network. The state and federal laws are meant to prevent large bills that you couldn't foresee and prevent, and what feels like a reasonable amount of due diligence to you may be different from the legal standard. If you do get a surprise bill that you think is covered by the law, contact the Colorado Division of Insurance or an advocacy group such as the Colorado Consumer Health Initiative, Fox said. We always advise consumers to do their homework to the greatest extent possible, he said. And in international COVID news, the Austrian Parliament approves vaccine mandate for adults, Dateline Vienna. Austria's parliament voted Thursday to introduce a COVID-19 vaccine mandate for adults beginning February 1st, the first of its kind in Europe, with maximum potential fines of up to $4,000 for people who do not comply after a series of reminders. Lawmakers voted 137-33 in favor of the measure, which will apply to all residents of Austria age 18 and older. Exemptions are made for pregnant women, people who for medical reasons cannot be vaccinated, or those who have recovered from the coronavirus in the previous 6 months. Officials say the mandate is necessary because vaccination rates remain too low in the small Alpine country. They say it will ensure that Austria's hospitals are not overwhelmed. And that was from the Associated Press. In related news, Spain, Portugal, UK consider new strategy, accepting COVID, by Aritz Parra of the Associated Press. Dateline Madrid. When the pandemic was first declared, Spaniards were ordered to stay home for more than 3 months. For weeks, they were not allowed outside, even for exercise. Children were banned from playgrounds, and the economy virtually stopped. But officials credited the draconian measures with preventing a full collapse of the health system. Lives were saved, they argued. Now, almost 2 years later, Spain is preparing to adopt a different COVID-19 playbook. With one of Europe's highest vaccination rates and its most pandemic-battered economies, the government is laying the groundwork to treat the next infection surge, not as an emergency, but an illness that is here to stay. Similar steps are under consideration in neighboring Portugal and in Britain. The idea is to move from crisis mode to control mode, approaching the virus in much the same way countries deal with the flu or measles. That means accepting that infections will occur and providing extra care for at-risk people and patients with complications. Spain's center-left Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez wants the European Union to consider similar changes now that the surge of the Omicron variant has shown that the disease is becoming less lethal. What we are saying is that in the next few months and years, we are going to have to think, without hesitancy and according to what science tells us, how to manage the pandemic with different parameters, he said Monday. Sanchez said the changes should not happen before the Omicron surge is over, but officials need to start shaping the post-pandemic world now. We are doing our homework, anticipating scenarios, he said. The World Health Organization has said it's too early to consider any immediate shift. The organization does not have clearly defined criteria for declaring COVID-19 an endemic disease, but its experts have said that it will happen when the virus is more predictable and there are no sustained outbreaks. It's somewhat a subjective judgment because it's not just about the number of cases. It's about severity and it's about impact, said Dr. Michael Ryan, the WHO's emergencies chief. The European Center for Disease Prevention and Control has advised countries to transition to more routine handling of COVID-19 after the acute phase of the pandemic is over. The agency said in a statement that more EU states, in addition to Spain, will want to adopt a more long-term sustainable surveillance approach. Just over 80% of Spain's population has received 2 vaccine doses, and authorities are focused on boosting the immunity of adults with 3rd doses. Vaccine-acquired immunity, coupled with widespread infection, offers a chance to concentrate prevention efforts, testing, and illness-tracking resources on moderate to high-risk groups, said Dr. Salvador Trench, head of the Spanish Society of Family and Community Medicine, which has led the call for a new endemic response. COVID-19 must be treated like the rest of illnesses, Trench said. The public also needs to come to terms with the idea that some deaths from COVID-19 will be inevitable, he said. For some other European governments, the idea of normalizing COVID-19 is at odds with their efforts to boost vaccination among reluctant groups. In Germany, where less than 73% of the population has received 2 doses and infection rates are hitting new records almost daily, comparisons to Spain or any other country are being rejected. We still have too many unvaccinated people, particularly among our older citizens, Health Ministry spokesman Andreas Defner said on Monday. Back in the U.S., Navy will let Wisconsin keep Badger statue for 50 more years. Dateline, Madison, Wisconsin. The Navy will let Wisconsin keep its beloved Badger statue for 50 more years, scrapping plans to move the sculpture to an East Coast museum. The statue was affixed to the first USS Wisconsin before World War I. The Naval Academy Museum lent it to the state in 1988. It has sat outside the governor's office in the state capitol since 1989, delighting thousands of tourists who rub its nose for good luck. The Academy Museum contacted state officials in March 2020, asking for the statue's return so it could be lent to the nonprofit Nauticus Museum in Norfolk, Virginia, where the second USS Wisconsin is berthed as an exhibit. State historians balked, and U.S. Representative Mike Gallagher, a Wisconsin Republican and former Marine, joined the effort to keep the statue in Madison. The Navy in February 2021 agreed to extend the loan for 2 years. Democratic Governor Tony Evers sent Navy Secretary Carlos Del Toro a letter in November asking that the Navy transfer ownership of the statue to the state permanently. The Badger should remain in Wisconsin, where it is seen by tens of thousands of visitors each year and is one of the most popular and beloved attractions in our beautiful state capital, Evers wrote. The Badger is not only part of the USS Wisconsin history, but it is now a part of the history of the Wisconsin state capital and a piece of pride for the Badger State and of residents from every corner of Wisconsin. Del Toro sent Evers a letter Tuesday saying the Navy is happy to extend the loan for the next 50 years. I prize the strong affinity that the citizens of Wisconsin have developed toward the Badger statue. It reflects the state's proud maritime heritage and deep ties to the U.S. Navy, Del Toro wrote. The Navy feels those ties, too, and we thank the people of Wisconsin for their ongoing interest in and support of our Navy and our nation's maritime history. And that was from the Associated Press. Thank you for joining us for the Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy.